Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 58, titled Sacred Feminine and Sacred Masculine.
I couldn't follow it. Please.
She has a question about the interaction between the sacred feminine and the sacred masculine, and she's interested in particular in the relationship between you
masculine?
And it. I think you're our representative here. You, will
Just
you,
kidding.
Michael?
Just kidding.
Justin, but she's interested to know how you stay married for so long, and any advice you have.
That's the sacred feminine's virtue, I think, putting up with me for so long. I think she's not here today, but actually, we say when we are asked that, and we have our 50th anniversary, actually, in a way this year, but formally next year. We say that the main thing is that partners in an intimate relationship share a spiritual partnership beyond the sort of mutual desire thing, where they have a commitment, kind of natural commitment by through understanding, to support each other's spiritual development and growth. So it isn't like that the relationship is in some sense thought of as a sort of worldly sacrifice, with each one having some different spiritual aspiration, or one of them thinking there's no such thing as a spiritual aspiration, the other one thinking that. So the sort of sense of respect for the other's longer term, beyond this life, destiny or something like that is really key, we think. Because if it's just like how much one is, you know, the passion thing, the romance, etc., how much one is getting from the other one, then there's no satisfaction. And then it breaks up and there's distraction and so forth. So we always say that's what, you know, what the thing is. I'm speaking now for the better half, as we say. And she isn't here. I think that's the true secret, actually, really. Which is why people have these kind of expressions like, a honeymoon is over and all this kind of thing. And why there's such a high divorce rate. Although, in a way, you know, in the earlier generations, people suffered a lot, basically because of some deep incompatibilities, but then they were held by force, kind of forced themselves, you know. And then that maybe wasn't so good because they were miserable. So I'm not against the divorce rate necessarily. And actually in this country, I don't know if you know that, but the highest divorce rate is in the red states, the fundamentalist states, where they are most trying to suppress women. And that's the highest divorce rate, which is a good sign, I think. And the long-term relationship. Then again, there's this whole thing. And then I would tell you, I think if you were here, that we all have these affinities from previous lives. And that's why I always like to tell Americans, if you do get divorced, don't be too nasty to your ex. Because you fell in love once. And you're probably going to another time in the next life. In the next life, they'll make a bad deal. If you make a nasty deal in this life. Because you fall in love again and again and again, and then it doesn't work out for whatever reason. But nothing is ever finished. Nobody who gets divorced is finished with their relationship with that person. And even they die, they're not finished. We're not finished with people. We'll meet them again. We won't necessarily recognize them, but our intuition, subliminally. You know, sometimes you meet someone who you instantly dislike and fear. Probably you have a good reason to from a previous life that you can't remember. And some people you instantly like, and that's also from previous things. So, you know, it's a complicated thing in a way, because equanimity that we talked about yesterday and equality means that you should love everyone in a way. But then, the idea that there are these special bonds that are lifetime, like, you know, geese, cranes, certain birds, you know, they have lifelong bonding, you know, and they It's a big thing in Indian literature, actually, the lifelong infidelity of geese, pairs of geese. And there's something very powerful in that, too, because helping each other through various phases of life, which can be difficult. So, you know, there's no one easy answer. There's no overall rule, except I really think it has to do with kind of soul respect, let's call it. S-O-U-L, soul respect, in addition to the physical things. How's that?
Great. Very helpful. Yeah.
What's that? Oh, thanks. Thank you.
Okay. One more question? Yeah.
I've just been thinking a lot about this, the idea, obviously, of reintroducing into social context this idea of sacred feminine and the equanimity between male and feminine energy. And obviously there are examples in history of matriarchies, and there's obviously contemporary examples of patriarchal societies. And I'm just wondering, for both of you, if you have a vision for what equanimity looks like in the balance of feminine and masculine energy.
I was thinking that envisioning it in a kind of social sense. That's why I recommended to you all that really grim book, you know, Counting for Nothing. I think it's like, for example, Nina and I had four children, and she had been a Swedish supermodel, the late 50s, early 60s. And we had a very strong spiritual bond from the beginning. But she really wanted to be with the children. And for her, that was her job that she really aspired to her, was her creativity. And then, you know, there's this whole thing about you're just a mother staying at home and the house and that. And then I was a professor, right? And I go through the horrible process here in America of getting tenure. Technically speaking, the paycheck came in my name. But actually, sometimes when she was not well or when some particular circumstance, I would stay home for a few days in a week, deal with the children. It's a much harder job. It's a huge job. So, for example, if in that kind of situation, if you come home, there's money, and it's divided, and that you earn half of it, and it's yours, and equal, you know, right there. And so then when there's a temper or an argument or a flare-up, it's like, I bring all the money, you know, like the people do, in either case. And nowadays, I guess there are some men who are the household person in a family, and then the women have some job, you know. And then probably they think I earn the money, you know, like, what is he doing? And so this total in you know, slavery really of the women and the complete unacknowledgement about the whole issue of childbirth and the huge effort that involves strain on the physical strain and really incredible. So I think equality is key, and then that's a very huge job on the planet. I think you have to close it, Justin, because it keeps blowing open. You know, it doesn't need to be open. No, the other one. Close? Okay. Because these religions are infected with the patriarchy. And then they think, well, God is male. It's the dumbest thing I ever heard. It's so stupid. And it also accounts for why God gets really cranky. Occasionally sends floods and fire and gets all freaked out and does all kinds of nasty things. Where's Mrs. God? Well, I'll tell you where she is. She's a ghost. She's the Holy Ghost. Oh, father and son. Wait a minute. Where's mom? Oh, she's a ghost. Poor thing. Beaten to death by the patriarch. She's just a ghost. It's the stupidest thing, really. I'm kidding. I'm not kidding. It's really lame. And the Muslims have a similar thing. And the Chinese, really, with the foot binding and all the weird crap they did to the women, and still do, actually, when they get back in the villages. And that's why there are so many Buddhist nuns. You know, the nun organization was a huge escape valve socially for Chinese women. And so, real equality. I mean, commit, actually call it. And I was just thinking this morning, driving over here, how happy I am that you came here and we have a women's gathering. I'm honored to participate in it. Because I'll tell you, women don't vote enough. They're so brainwashed that they have no power. What they think doesn't matter. If every woman in this country voted, we could drop all the primaries and everything. And then Bernie could be Treasury Secretary, I'm telling you, and get out to the bank. And we wouldn't have bad governments if every woman voted, you know, especially single women with children who don't vote, who most desperately need a strong government and a sane government. They can't get together to vote. And there's a huge percentage don't vote. So this group, I hope, has a mission. Each one get at least 100 people to vote from your blogs and your Facebook and whatever it is. Make sure everybody votes, every female votes. It's really, really critical. So I'd like to turn further thing of what Sarah asked. And that is that right, Sarah? Oh, good. And that is this. Back to the original framework thing that I tried to establish today about this idea of kind of evolution is to be able to expand your sense of identification with everybody. So that's the height of evolution, which is called Buddhahood or enlightenment. Then the horrible, most horrible thing in evolution is to be so totally isolated that you're practically like living in an iron cage, you know, and nobody can get to you, you know. But of course you're in prison there, you know, and you're totally isolated. So you have like a gamut of evolutionary forms that are good versus bad, of shrunken away and isolated versus totally interwoven with the universe, right? In that light, Buddhist ethical rules are given in a marvelous pattern of what are called the tenfold paths of skillful and unskillful evolutionary action, which is actually what karma means. It doesn't mean some fate or some sort of automatic destiny or fatalism. It means karma just means cause and effect, an evolutionary cause and effect, and, you know, an action that causes you to change, a shaping action, which all actions do, right? So if you have that as a scale, a vast identification versus, you know, transcending the self-other barrier versus completely getting locked up in the self as your sort of evolutionary register, you know, then the three skillful acts, which are usually translated as virtuous or moral, but actually the literal word is skillful, meaning you improve the evolution of yourself, at least to start with, in that, right? So the first is don't kill people or animals, any kind of life. Because taking another life means that's not part of my universe. So you're isolating from the continuum of that life. You take the body, you don't get killed the being, because the soul goes on, but you take away their body. So that you then become more isolated, and then you perceive other beings as maybe killing you, and you get more like closed up, right? Whereas the skillful thing is save lives. And then when you save a life, it somehow belongs to you, you belong to it, it's part of your world, and you have expanded your two lives. You follow me? Then stealing, what you call stealing, which literally means taking what is not given to you. The opposite being giving. So that's the sort of with possessions. And again, in the gamut of narrowing and isolating versus embracing and expanding. And in that light, intimacy, the sexual interaction, is not just adultery, as often it's translated that way, stupidly. But it isn't that issue of adultery or something. That depends on societies. There are societies where there are polyandry. There's polyandrous. Tibet is polyandrous, for example. One woman often marries two or three brothers to keep them from killing each other. Saving land, actually, so they don't subdivide land in a way it relates to society and the earth and so on. But the sexual thing is where beings naturally and biologically can reach moments of transcending self-other boundary. So to use that moment with beings in a harmful way without caring about the partner, just using the partner as some sort of instrument, is very unskillful. Because even at the time when you, as a human, you have the lesson of melting one into another, you're like exploiting, you're doing something to some other thing, and you're emphasizing the otherness. So then that's terrible evolutionary unskill versus that moment being something to expand your sense of connection and by truly caring for the other equal to yourself or even more than yourself, better. Because usually people are naturally self-responsible. In other words, the sort of ethical element of it, the spiritual element, connects to the ethical element in a really beautiful way. If you see that being the source of evolution, kind of evolution that is a multi-life evolution, a soul evolution.